mandate is to increase access to higher education through the provision of university degrees completely online or through distance education. And in keeping with this part of our mandate, that is to increase access to education, one of our board members, Dr. Fritz Pennicott, president of Athabasca University, has challenged us, is encouraging us to explore an open courseware initiative. And as you all know, open courseware was brought to global attention and awareness by MIT, which with the help of some $10 million, managed to place close to 1,800 classroom courses or parts of courses online free of charge. And I guess when the world noticed that there was no major upheaval or major consequence to that other than some great PR for MIT, other universities followed. And today we have over 200 universities in a dozen countries that have added many thousands of course pieces to open courseware websites. Now, how used and useful this content actually is debatable. But it's not an uncommon opinion that while this was a bold and mindset-changing project, that without context, pedagogy, instructional design, or engagement, or some possibility of a pathway toward credit, the educational value of much of this current open content is limited. So we have asked, I gathered a group of panelists who are challenged to talk about what they think a world's best online course designed for open access at this particular point in time might look like. And we're going to be doing this as a discussion. They're going to present some thoughts. We'll be taking questions as we go and maybe challenging each other. And you also have a sheet in front of you where you ask some questions if you don't have a chance to ask them publicly, to give your thoughts, and then either to leave them on the chair if you like, and with your name if you like, and we'll send you a summary report, or to bring them to the next session, which is a workshop where we'll be asking all of you, all participants, to contribute their ideas of what we need to consider, what we need to think about if we're creating a best online first year. So I'm going to ask you, Dr. Pennicott, why did you introduce
Okay. Obviously, a good question. Since I knew it was planted, I figured I'd be able to answer that too. It's about a year and a half ago, I was invited by the International Council on Distance Education, which, in partnership with UNESCO, was looking at standards for open courseware. They thought it was a good idea, but they wanted to figure out what might the international community do to develop those standards. During those conversations, and these were, well, they were all presidents of open universities, and as you probably know, presidents may be, I think up there, but sometimes they have trouble with the practicalities. And somebody said, oh, well, surely whatever standards we develop must be MIT compliant. And my head did a quick turn thinking, and what do you mean? Does MIT have perhaps articulated standards that I wasn't aware of, which is quite possible? And probed a little further and be quite clear that the person who made the comment hadn't actually looked at the content, but they had heard of it, and it had, in fact, de facto become a standard. Conversations then moved around to what other institutions had been doing. For example, what the British had been doing, and became familiar with. But in fact, some people thought, this is a pretty good model because it's got some embedded pedagogy, and so I decided to enroll in one of their open courses and am now studying the Brighton Pavilion. A very particularistic, but nevertheless very interesting. I then started to think about if open courseware is to be there and it's to be totally and truly transformative, how can we achieve that? And where can we really make a difference? I've been prodded by the work of Carol Twigg, who got a big Pew Foundation grant. Now, she worked largely with residential universities and in classroom experiences rather than distance experiences. What she looked at was the 25 key courses at about 30 universities, largely in the first year. What she examined in particular those courses in which there were the highest failure rates, and they were significant failure rates of things like maths and even in some of the humanities and social sciences. She then looked at using various devices and experiences to improve those student learning experiences in the first year, and in fact improve them where there may have been a 40-50% failure rates to reducing as much as low as 10% in some of those institutions. She used devices that distance learning and e-learning professionals would have said, yeah, that's exactly what you should have done. You would have improved your learning outcomes. So when I read those initially, I thought, oh, well, you know, surprise, surprise. You start doing some blended learning activities. You start using the appearance of greater personal control of learning. You know, surprise. Well, that's when it made me start to think, what would happen if we had foundation courses, that is, courses that would outline those learning outcomes that everyone in the first year ought to have, ought to make, like in mathematics or algebra or in history or any of these disciplines. What would happen? Would that be more transformative than what MIT had done or the British Open had done or what the Dutch had done? If we started to establish some international agreeable standards in some areas. Now, there are all sorts of problems with that, and that's what really excited me most. It wasn't that we could do something. It was all the problems that this would create. And the first problem is an obvious one. Which subjects might we work at? Well, you could argue endlessly about that, but I thought, what about finding out those courses in which people have the highest failure rates? Maybe that's where we could start. That might be transformative. And my touring around Asia and China and Europe, there were some commonalities there. Then secondly, the big question is, a question that was asked was culture. What do you to make this culturally appropriate? How does one do that? Well, that's just a series of knots that are just endless and so wonderful to debate and discuss and ultimately to deal with a reality. Because once you put it online, there is a reality there. And then, of course, I've always been interested in embedding pedagogy within information. That is, no subject, the information sits unto itself. If it's not embedded in good pedagogical practice, whatever that might be, which would have to be culturally sensitive, technologically appropriate, well, what would that be? Again, endless questions that would go on and on. Then the immediate question that always came up was, what about student readiness? You know, mm-hmm. Students are not all prepared to reach that same benchmark. I tried the British Open elementary stats course. I'd taken stats. I can tell you I wasn't ready for that. So I would have needed a lot of readiness for something like that. So how do we do readiness when we have an international venue to deal with? And then modes of delivery. Well, we have all sorts of technologies that we could manage. What's most appropriate to individual cultures? What's available to various cultures? Should you allow delivery in print as well as in various e-formats and various digital formats? Then what about the outcomes that we want? And I'm very suspicious of outcome-driven pedagogy, given what's happening in the U.S. with the Spelling Commission. I'm very concerned about how that impacts us. But again, it's a debate that I meet with our government frequently, and that's the thing they always point at to you. And when we say, oh, we're not keen, they drive it to us through a performance envelope, by you get an extra $1 million if you do what I tell you, sort of thing. Well, money motivates people like me to perhaps an inordinate degree because I got to pay salaries to people. Then the next issue was, what about articulation? How are these courses to be used by various nations or institutions? And could they be articulated or not articulated? Well, there's a whole interesting debate around that. And then, I think a really important debate that Alan just made clear this morning is, how could it be intellectually sustainable? And that becomes a really important issue. And how would you make it intellectually sustainable? How would you make sure it had intellectual growth and underpinnings? And that's equally important. And then, of course, if you solve all those problems, which I hope we all can, I certainly can, but I know these people can, how would we operationalize it? That is, how would we actually pull it off? What if we did the 12 foundation or 15 foundational courses? What if someone gave us, let's say, here's $20 million, go do your thing? How would we do it? And then the last one is, because this is something that interests me, though it may not interest a lot of people, what's the business model? Can you make money off this? Perhaps not in a traditional way, but could you? And I think you actually could make an inordinate amount of money off it, making it free, yet making a business case around it. So those are just some of the questions I posed, and this is why I'm so interested in hearing what the panelists have to say, and I'm so interested in the next section in hearing what the community at large has to say, and how we can engage this into, let's say, build lakes under it. So thank you very much.
Okay, George.
Okay, well, against that well-conceived and clearly thought-out viewpoint, I will introduce chaos and randomness. I think, in my eyes, if I was to, you know, ask or try to describe what would be an ideal course for me for what I see coming forward in the future, I would use two words to describe it. First of all, it would be networked. It would be a function of networks. And secondly, it would occur within an ecology. And I would put all the onus on the institution to design the ecology and all the onus on the learners to form their own network. So that, I think, would be really my first starting point. I think content is still a favored stepchild of many academic institutions, and I do think it's on its way out of favor, or at least it needs to be. Content as a distinct entity, because it has a very short lifespan in certain disciplines. Now, what I'm talking about here isn't going to be applicable to every single discipline. If you're in computer science, for example, you know that you probably don't have textbooks, because textbooks as a content piece aren't going to be around long enough for you to use them well. Most likely, you're doing your learning in a community format or something like a network in your discussions with your professors. So when I hear individuals, you know, designing incredibly expensive courses or incredibly involved textbooks, I don't see that as sustainable, simply because what I at least conceive to be the emerging nature of knowledge in today's society is one that is at odds with how we've crafted content in our academic systems. So what would content look like? Well, quite simply, I mean, there's lots of examples of it. Unfortunately, the examples don't quite have the academic credibility that might be more suitable to this discussion. I think Wikipedia is one that I readily could refer to, but an academic version of Wikipedia where everyone who's involved in psychology contributes to a wiki so that you have one source, if you will, for psychology, and each individual department and university can pull whatever they want off of that, use it in their own institution. But, you know, to me, that's a simple model that I think there's too many egos involved to make it work well, but I think that's really the way it needs to be. I also think that the creation process isn't one that should be exclusively done by the experts. I think the activities of the learners that go through it should be as prominent a contributor to the creation of content as should be the experts in a field. Now, that raises a whole new can of worms that we can get into a little bit later on. The content needs to be pedagogically neutral. When we're designing content, it needs to be created in such a manner that it can be repurposed in as many ways as possible that aren't yet conceivable by the original creators of the content. When we start disseminating, adding quality to it, determining the value of it, I think at that point we move again into a network type model where, much like we see happening with DIG, and I don't want to harp on these read-write tools as our salvation, because they aren't. They come with their own tools. Mm-hmm. But the read-write web tools right now represent a level of freedom, a level of democracy, a level of choice and participation that our current models don't offer. So I'm appealing to those ideals of read-write tools, mm-hmm. not to the notion of, you know, Web 2.0 as a jargon term. Mm-hmm. I also think that the notion of conversation-centric learning is vital, whereas in a traditional course, the instructor or faculty member has what I would call primary voice. And I think in today's world, primary voice is, life's too confusing and too complex for that. We can take any subject and get confused over it with just a few quick blog readings and different viewpoints. And I think it's important that we do get confused over any subject rather than accepting a primary voice. So I think that's another part of the vision I would say is it needs to be multi-narrative in terms of how the content is delivered. The instructor, if you will, and pedagogy at this point is applied twofold, not by the institution on the content, but by the learner in participation with the faculty members where the pedagogy applies. This obviously opens up, you know, the distribution element of it. It should be available, for lack of a better word, in any device and in any format. Learners should not come to us and they should not come to our space for their learning content. Our content should come to them, and the discussion in a distributed manner needs to occur in their own existing devices. Now, when I say these things, I'm going to pass it off right away because we agreed to just do a few short minutes here and then argue more later. But this does challenge roughly everything, and it should, because there really is, I believe, a fundamental change in the context and characteristic of knowledge today that we as academics often haven't understood. So it does change what we mean with pedagogy. It does change what instructional design means. It does change the role of an instructional designer. It changes the role of an institution to one that creates, disseminates, and validates content for learners to ones that creates the space, the ecology, if you will, in which this creation and dissemination will occur. So those are just a few very quick, vaguely defined thoughts that, and I think education, if you see what's happening, even in economics, what, you know, Beinhacker has written about, the economic model that we've seen in the centuries gone by of cause-effect have largely been replaced or are starting to be replaced with models where we see economics as self-organizing, and we see that the cause-effect rules that we once held in classical economics don't work anymore, and we're finding more value in the model of chaos theory and complexity science to start to define the self-organization of markets. And I think a similar trend will occur academically.
Thank you. Joan.
I'm going to pick up on chaos. And I'm going to agree with all that you've said, and I'm going beyond. When I was asked to speak on the panel, I was focusing in, first of all, on the notion of the ideal online first-year course. And then when I had an opportunity to read Fritz's paper, I realized that this was to be part of a larger cluster of courses, and that we were looking at the development of a core curriculum. And Vicky said, pick up whatever you want to work with, Joan, and so it's the notion of that course fitting into the core curriculum that I'm choosing to speak to this morning. When I look at this from the perspective of being the structural designer, which I was for many years, I agree with everything that has been said. When I look at it from the perspective of administrator, I can resonate with a lot of what Fritz has said, because SFU is part of the COHERE group, and we are part of one of those interinstitutional course development projects, and there are many, many issues and very many pieces of logic that need to be figured out, and that in itself can be very challenging. But I didn't want to get bogged down in the minutiae, and I kept saying, well, Joan, go to the big picture, and to me the big picture was the core curriculum. And as I was thinking on the plane out here from Vancouver the other day, I thought, with the big picture, I see so many canvases before me. And I see so many artists who may want to be the creator of, and who are the creators of those canvases. And just and depending on who the artist is and where he or she lives and the cultural values, the cultural norms of those home societies, what kind of picture would that individual create, and how do these core courses and these online pedagogies fit into those? I don't, when I was talking to Molly O'Neill, who was in the audience, and we were preparing for a presentation this afternoon, and she said, oh, you know, Joan, we can get almost bogged down to the point of immobility. Mm-hmm. And I'm not suggesting that for a moment. I think we do. We obviously have to prepare learning materials, learning opportunities for people in a multitude of complexes and environments. But I am interested in the metrics, the question of how would we measure whether something is good, something is excellent, something is exemplary, be it a course or a core curriculum. And I think when I comment about being conscious of where people are, wherever they are in the world, is not intended to be any attempt to immobilize or keep things as they are. And as I was saying to Ella just before we began, when we think about going global, and that is the nature of this enterprise, and we say things like, everybody will be able to get connected, everybody will be able to contribute, everyone will be able to participate, the cold, hard reality is that everybody will not. And so we have to be conscious of what it is that we are choosing to do. Personally speaking, others may have different ideas, but personally speaking, I see nothing wrong with deciding what we will do, who we will be able to serve, and consciously identifying who we will not be able to serve and who will not be able to take advantage of those opportunities. I see nothing wrong with that and a whole lot good with it. I think when we move as educators into areas of irresponsibility is when we just assume that what we experience in our very fortunate, privileged environments is what everyone experiences. And people have said to me, oh, Joan, you know, everybody's out there, everybody's online, everybody can participate. In the last week, I was talking to someone who oversees an online graduate program that we are offering out of SFU. And she was talking about a young man in Southeast Asia, the country is not important, who she referred to as the fellow who just can't get access. The library, though we have many, many databases, online databases, that was great, but he couldn't get the other kinds of materials that he needed in the country in which he lived. He wasn't privileged to have the kind of high-speed access that he would need in order to do the kind of work that's being asked at the graduate level. Last week as well, a colleague of mine who's recently immigrated to Canada talked about computers being everywhere in the university in which she had formerly lived her professional life. But she said, Joan, if we really want to extend education out into the communities and the small villages in that particular country, we have to do something other than use computers because it's too expensive. You may be able to buy them, you may not be able to get them online. So I'm really pleased to hear Fritz talk about the various modalities and how we reach. So I think when I go back to think, well, how would we measure this? What is the metric by which we would determine whether this is in fact exemplary, if it is excellent? I think it will be the extent to which we really bore down into our souls and our minds and really become aware of our own cultural orientation, the extent to which that is similar or different from the other people with whom we want to work throughout the world, the extent to which we allow ourselves to be educated from those very interesting, transformative features of their lives, and that we knowingly make decisions and communicate those decisions to potential learners. Because education is a transformative activity. That is the nature of the beast that we are all interested in, and Fritz used that word transformative earlier on. So my question to myself is, in what way do we want this particular initiative to be transformative? And if we're talking about a core curriculum determined by who and for what purposes? And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Ellen.
Well, you heard me introduce myself earlier today as a learning activist and an accidental software executive. And in this particular conversation, I must tell you that I am quite pleased to step back into that accidental role and be quite pleased that I leave the hard parts of this conversation to my academic colleagues, and I find myself in the role of wanting to be that good toolmaker who makes sure that as the community of scholars and practitioners considers the ways in which they want their experiences to evolve, that those of us on the other side of the conversation make sure that the tools are there to make sure that these experiences can be built in whatever way the practice community determines makes the most sense for that community. And so this is also part of a dialogue that I'm pleased, and in fact I hope we can find ways of encouraging to a greater degree as we go forward on these initiatives, corporations and the Academy have got to find better ways of finding common ground, because without one another, it is very, very easy to lose our way. But having said that, now I get to go back to being that toolmaker, because in my world, when I start looking at the perfect learning experience, I don't know that I would necessarily look at it as a course right now. And while you heard me say before that I'm not necessarily certain that I would look toward a monolithic curriculum, on the other hand, I know that there needs to be an underpinning or an infrastructure upon which experiences can be built. So you heard my notion of building cathedrals of thought or little bitty tract homes. I mean, the fact is that with these tools, you can pretty much do whatever you want. So here is the challenge. If I'm looking at what I want to do is to make sure that a learning experience is flexible, that we focus the positioning of the curriculum, to Fritz's point, on a core set of perhaps competencies, looking at the results that we hope to achieve. So for me, I will start going backwards. Mm-hmm. Tools that allow us to achieve results such as creative expression. We want our well-educated people around the world to be able to express themselves, to contribute in a digital dialogue, but if we don't give people basic ways of getting started, it's never going to happen. We want to be able to focus on ways of collaborating and sharing information with one another, to negotiate new knowledge with one another. Now, of course, there's this big question I have in the back of my mind now, having come through my own coursework experiences as a cognitivist, just coming out of the behavioral world, still fairly behavioral in my orientation because that's what we did back in those days, and having to relearn it as a cognitivist, only to find that, in fact, no, that's wrong too. We must be constructivists. And I will tell you that now I'm realizing that as I look at what's happening around us, I'm laughing, saying, aha, Bandura's back. Social learning is everywhere. So as we start looking at how we want this to come forward, the tools have to be able to let us choose which of those matter when we need it. We want to be able to build courseware that's flexible enough to be reusable when it should be, disposable when it's okay to be, looking at being interoperable so that the value of the investment can be realized over time, looking at things that can be repurposable. I mean, okay, we all know that PDF and Flash are a lot of places, and we all know that for those of us who've been working with reusable learning objects and things like that, that there's this little secret about the Flash blob. You can't break it apart once it's been flashed. And so, of course, in my world, we're trying to think of how do you figure out ways of wrapping your content in a way that keeps it together, that it's secure and reliable, and you know what's there, but you can also disassemble so they can be disaggregated and re-aggregated in different ways. Now, of course, this raises all kinds of other questions about to what degree do any one of us have the time to be pursuing our profession as a craft? The craft-based model of education is really maybe not necessarily where we can spend our time now, because none of us have either the time, the ability, or the resources to actually do all this construction ourselves. So how do we make this smart enough to be able to be assembled in ways that do reflect the needs of the institution, the needs of the learners, the needs of the community, the needs of the country? So I guess for me, I'm looking at ways of being flexible, and I'm looking at ways of being able to anticipate where to go next and making sure, I think to everyone's point, if you want it to be mobile, it should be able to be mobile. You want that same content to be on your desktop, you should be able to do that. You want to be able to get it quickly in a rich, immersive experience, very cool. You want that flat file PDF? You know what? You should have that too. And you should be able to have it on whatever terms you want to define for yourself. So for me, that would be the perfect course and the perfect curriculum. A small, modest task.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, thanks. I wasn't expecting to go last, but that's okay. It just means my notes are now really hard to read. especially with these eyes. When Carol Twigg's work was introduced, describing the lowering of the failure rate from 40% to 10%, my first thought was that this must have created a crisis at the university in question, because they simply weren't prepared to accommodate that many people actually passing the course. And, I mean, I took these courses. I started out as a science major. Took these courses, and they were commonly thought of as filter courses or get rid of the deadweight courses or narrow down the field courses. The purpose of the course wasn't to actually graduate people. The purpose of the course was to select the people who would be privileged enough to go on to second, third, and fourth year. And if we open up that gate, we might not be prepared for the results that follow. So I'm going to caution against doing it in bits. I think having part of the system as an open system that everyone can use and another part of the system is closed and locked down or expensive is asking, in a sense, for a system that is by design dysfunctional. Now we have to ask ourselves, what are the objectives? What are we up to when we're talking about open learning resources or provision of education of any kind? Are we up to enabling learning opportunities? Are we up to providing credentials and accreditation? Or is our objective to obtain cost savings? Mm-hmm. You know, people are always quick to say, oh, I don't really mean cost savings because I don't really want to threaten any academics' jobs. And they say that in one breath, and then in the very next breath they say, but we need to figure out how to educate 1 million people on just a small amount of money. So one of those things is our objective. You can't have both of those things. Is it to serve everybody or to serve some people? And again, I caution against doing it all in bits, but I also caution against trying to do it all. In my own work, I bracket certain aspects of things. One of the things I bracket is accessibility, and I know I should probably talk about accessibility, but I try to focus on things that I know, understanding and realizing that there are other people who are going to handle things like accessibility. Another thing I bracket is bandwidth, access to computers. There are very good people working on things like the One Laptop Per Child project. There are really smart people developing technologies like iBurst and WiMAX that will provide broadband internet access in regions without good wireline infrastructure. So looking at this, taking this as a perspective, now I come to the particular challenge and ask, well, what would the best online course look like? And right away, that kind of language bothers me. But my first reaction is Canada's best online course will not be written by an institution. It will not be written by a professor. It probably won't be written at all. It won't be a course at all. Because I think it would be a mistake to replicate that model of slice and dice and package and deliver online, because online isn't the sort of medium that supports that sort of content. So what would it look like? Well, if we look at some of the challenges, and one of the challenges that was raised was the challenge of sustainability, things like cost, things like intellectual sustainability, we understand that we have to move beyond the concept of we provide this for you, right? And what we have to do is think about what sort of mechanisms can we put into place, what sort of opportunities can we enable that allow people to do these things for themselves, because that will address the cost problem, that will address the intellectual sustainability problem. So when we look at this, we look at things like Wikipedia, and we see that people do have the capacity to create very good resources for themselves. We look at things like collective intelligence that allows us to organize our learning materials in the first instance through things like tagging, but even through things like observing people's behavior, watching what they link. Google creates a search algorithm, not by having a bunch of professors go out and pick the best materials, but by looking at what people link to on their webpage. Now, of course, there's all kinds of gaming in that, but nonetheless, imagine what Google would look like if they hired 100,000 academics to organize the web. It would be awful. And I'll tell you, after we had a chat last night, and I got home and I sat down, and I wanted to know how the hockey game came out. And so, yeah, you didn't know I was thinking about something else the whole time. I sat down and I typed in Google, Ottawa Senators, and I got the game results. Imagine professors doing that. So, okay. And even things like localization, again, you can't produce localization for people. You have to create the capacity, create the conditions under which localization can happen. And that's one of the things that OpenCourseWare actually has tapped into. One of the projects I've been very loosely affiliated with is something called OOPS. And what OOPS is a project that takes OpenCourseWare, produced by MIT, and translates it into Chinese. And the way they're doing it is not hiring a bunch of translators, because think of what the cost of that would be. But they put the materials on a wiki and have the community do the translation, and the translation just gets better and better over time. Okay, so is any of this academically sound? Who knows? Haven't a clue. So, and that's a problem, because there is this credibility issue. And so, when asked what I would do to create the greatest access to educational resources, I look at what the conditions of scarcity are. Because in my view, much of our field is dominated by what can only be characterized as artificial scarcity. We've created conditions under which it's hard to get something where it would not necessarily be hard to get something without these conditions. So what's really hard to get? Well, I look at my own career and degrees, accreditation, credentialing, right? This is where the bottleneck is. And it seems to me that if we were serious about enabling, as opposed to providing, the widest range of academic opportunities, that we would, if you will, open source accreditation. Now, I'm not even going to try to sketch a model like that, but I'll sketch some of the criteria. Some system of accreditation or recognition for academic achievement that is open so everybody understands what it is, which is accessible so everybody can get at it, affordable so you don't have to pay the equivalent of not even a modest house, but a fairly expensive house in order to get all the testing. Some sort of mechanism, not outcomes-based or standards-based, because that produces, yes, the silliness we see south of the border, but some mechanism whereby people can demonstrate and other people can know that the demonstration has happened, some sort of learning results. Now, again, this is a large thinking project, and I'm certainly not going to say, oh, well, you just do this, 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 and this, and you're done. But, you know, ePortfolios is a bit of a step in that direction, but really where I get my models from are things like, and I'm going to say that horrible word, things like games. I grew up playing MUDs, and the way MUDs were set up is they were created by the users, but you had to be sure that the users weren't going to write really bad code, because if they wrote really bad code, the MUD wouldn't work and everybody would hate it, and MUDs wanted to be loved. So the way it was set up is a user would go through the MUD and they'd be presented with various quests. And the quests would require, in order to solve them, that the user achieve some sort of understanding about how MUDs are built. And so the user would individually, or sometimes using ad hoc groups, and some quests required groups, go through the MUD, solve these quests. And once they solved the quests, that in itself demonstrated that they had the capacity, the ability to code the MUD, and so they were promoted to wizards. I became a wizard. I was very proud of myself. That's how I proved I knew how to code. So, I mean, that's just one model. In my thinking, though, and it was mentioned before, is that we should be thinking of environments rather than content, where these environments allow users to connect to, acquire, create, trade, even sell content of whatever description that they want, but also in which these environments, through progressive interaction with this environment and with the other people in this environment, a person can demonstrate in a clear and open way that they have achieved academic excellence of some sort. And it would be the role of things like universities and professors not to provide learning for people, but to enable, put in place the mechanisms that enable people to demonstrate that they have learned. That's what I would do if I had the money in the control. And I'll end it on that note.
Thank you. Well, thank you, everyone. I see people out there madly taking notes and the wheels turning. So I would like to open it up to the audience to pose some questions about the panelists. And if you've been doing some thought to it and jotting down sort of what ideas presented from your own experience or what intrigued you most, and Questions. Terry, your question.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up on Stephen's with the whole accreditation thing, because that really is what drives a lot of what we call formal education as opposed to informal. And Stephen's first example, you know, was the filtering and the math that you wanted to quit. Well, I tried to be a mud, and people like, or a wizard, but people like Stephen cut me out because I didn't learn enough to be a coder, you know. So I guess the essence of it is, in my mind, is we have to provide opportunities for people to push themselves. If they're going to transform, nobody likes to change except babies and all that sort of thing. And I noticed on Ellen's 9 points or something, there were things like induce or participate and all this. But what is it going to make it for the people to push themselves to go that extra kind of a mile? Mm-hmm. And we all use Wikipedia, but I'll bet how many people here have actually entered into Wikipedia, excluding the entry for your own name? I'm pretty happy that you've actually entered. So this is a group of very highly educated people. We have all used Wikipedia, but 10% of us have actually contributed. So what we have to do, I think, is really look at the whole assessment thing, and I think ePortfolios is a small step in the right direction. And then you have to say, well, who can evaluate the ePortfolio, and what kind of criteria are they going to use? And, you know, we have really been hung up on multiple choice tests, and we know that they've got problems with that. And then we've gone to essays. And, you know, you can buy an essay for $10 from a zillion people. You can get an original one crafted for $15. So we got to do a lot more than those two examples. And so I think that, and it's so culturally sensitive, as Joan said, you know, the different groups. So I think we have to talk about, you know, having an economic model that rewards assessors for the demonstrations of learning that is culturally relevant.
Just on a quick note, I've gone through PLAR processes in the past, which is a little bit. Students have dealt with as well. You start PLAR and you find out, you know what, that course is looking pretty attractive once you get started, because it is a rigorous process. So those are things that you look at as well. Once you informalize or you open up the aspects of assessment, that level of control of how do you exhibit your learning can overwhelm some students. And I've found, and quite honestly, I would say more often than not, once a student has been completely introduced to the notion of portfolio and a PLAR model, that a course can become quite attractive. Yes?
If I could add to that, one of the things that concerns me most about, let's say, the new technologies and what I call the Euro-American way of, say, learning, is that it's not necessarily, whoops. Well, someone will shut us down.
As soon as we have the music, we'll start table dancing.
Okay. I'm still recording, though.
Well, we don't need light. We've got, yeah. It's one of the things that concerns me most is light, yes, obviously. Shedding light on the subject. Are some of the cultural contexts is the moment I see the MITs, let's see, the British Open and the Dutch Open saying that we've got a open courseware solution, it's actually driven by by Euro-American cultural imperialism in a new form. When you actually sit down with people in, say, India, and you sit and start to listen about how do you see learning happening in your community, and how do you learn, how do you deal with, you know, the concept of, of elders? How do you deal with the concept of generational learning? And how is that model different from what we might experience? How do we look at Indigenous learning in Canada? And have we ever taken a course in, and I know some universities have, in Indigenous science, but embedding North America as a sub element rather than Indigenous knowledge as a sub element in Eurocentric science. So I think we have a lot of careful thinking to do when you plan one of these. One of the other, and this is just an observation and experience, I usually once a month get somebody attempting to buy either one or more Athabasca University courses, saying, well, sell us your BA and we'll do with it as we wish. Well, that's very interesting, but part of me says, is this appropriate? Is this, other than the bottom line, an appropriate ethical act? And it's a very long discussion. Is me putting online as free coursework, is that an appropriate act as well? Who does one talk to this about? Who are you impacting? There is an incredible set of questions that to which there are no easy answers if you want to be, let's say, a responsible being, because everything you do has an action. Everything you also do creates a new economic environment, whether you determine what it is or whether you simply allow it to happen. For example, if one did open, courseware, and I'll use the word course even though it could mean learning modules that are somehow interrelated. Okay, now how could the private sector make revenues out of that? For example, could you have a private sector entity saying, we'll do accreditation. We'll actually have it's almost like a TOEFL experience. We will be able to say, you've managed this knowledge, and we will actually be so reputable that you will come to us to pay for that accreditation. A different model, which could marginalize some public institutions that offer that accreditation. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Don't know, but it could happen. So it's just that this requires, I think, a lot of reflection and care to figure out in what directions we might move things without purposefully doing going in that direction.
There was a question here. This is a comment to your point about the private sector being the accreditation. It is not for profit, but it is private mm-hmm. sector. An example, and it speaks to Stephen's point mm-hmm. about get to the end point whichever way you can. An example in Canada is the Financial Planner Standards Council, which is the accrediting body. It offers no courses. It has approved, I believe, the last I heard, 68 programs, which would mean you can, at any university, any college, any private sector, you can mm-hmm. create your own courseware to bring somebody to write their exam. Mm-hmm. But also, you must write their exam. So what we find, of course, is that some people cop one route, which is cheap and cheerful, fail the test, and end up, So the proof in the pudding is who has the greatest success in getting somebody to pass the exam. And interestingly enough, one of the most successful preparations for it, especially if you're an accountant, apparently, is to buy this book that's got 1,000 questions on it. 1,000 questions and answers. And I look at the blogs for people preparing for the Standards Council exam, and they keep saying, oh, the Gobay 1,000 notes, the Gobay 1,000 questions. But meanwhile, there are universities that have 7, 8 courses preparing them for that. Now, you might speak to another point, too, about the cultural relativity and who is for what and what is appropriate. I had a conversation yesterday with a guest here from Namibia. And we were talking about this, like for somebody like us from Canada to help them create programs, and we don't want to impose our values on her. And we ended up deciding that maybe the thing to do is to have a conversation. And they would simply listen, and you would exchange, and they could extract from what you have to offer whatever it is that they find useful. And that conversation went so far And then I started to tell her about the sessions in yesterday about Red River College introducing e-learning to Sri Lanka. And I said, well, you know, started talking about introducing teams for e-learning. And I was thinking, that's our experience. You really do have that team. And then you start talking about needing learning objectives. And I said, absolutely, that's the way we work too. You have to have learning objectives. And I'm thinking, but when I was in the, when I taught at university, we didn't have learning objectives in the beginning. You were the prof, you had the course, you did what you liked. You graded how you wanted, and you were power, and you loved it. but all of a sudden, 15 years ago, we were all told we had to have learning objectives, so we all taught along, but we didn't like it. But when you are preparing a need course, it's ultimately binary. And somebody has to decide it's either on or it's off, it's on or it's off. So you start to get constricted. So I was saying to her, even though I don't think learning objectives should be the only way that you can learn, if you're going to create a course, you have got to structure it. And the more you structure it, it comes back to the theme of the course. The medium does become the message. The technology does constrain what you do, how you do it, and how the outcome is.
Then why build a course? Why build a course then, if you know this is going to be the outcome?
Because there are certain times in which that's how you want to. I'll give you an example. Sometimes I don't understand it. Some of the things that we do is create online courses for compliance courses for banks. And the bank will pass us this regulation, which may be 20 pages. And they will say to us, create an attractive, interactive training program so that our bank won't get sued because we broke the law, right. And do it inside an hour. So the employee really must know they really must. But they don't want to take it, and we've only got an hour. And I keep thinking, but it's only 20 pages, and it's written in plain English. Why don't they just read it?
We have a few more questions, I think. Do you want to finish a comment?
No,
you
did just
was there any other response from any of the panelists? Okay.
Demand is such an interesting word. Demand is in supply and demand. Demand is in command and demand.
To the notion that Ontario was talking about this and a couple of others of the accreditation, the transferability. And so many conferences I go to right now, my unit is within a continuing education unit. That challenge is always there. So we have two things bumping up against each other. Mm-hmm. The opportunity for flexibility, we see that as a value, versus the university jealousies, if I can use that term, of holding on to the accreditation, the demand, the reputation, their brand, or whatever. And I think one of the things, I know there's work that is going on in this area, but for this course, mm-hmm. or this initiative, and for many others that are happening in universities and other places as well, places of learning, however you define those, if we could collectively work on this one with powerful people at the table, we might just start chipping away at that pushback that is really denying people an opportunity to fulfill their intellectual and their social potential.
Yeah. Thank you, George.
I was just going to make one quick point on accreditation. Like, accreditation is no less new. If you make accreditation a new value point in the education circle, you get the same degree of ideology buffeting accreditation as a concept that we can have with content right now. But there's some great models of accreditation accreditation isn't the right word. It's tied to identity. It's tied to reputation.
Yeah.
And, accreditation, I'm leery based on what Terry said as well, that multiple choice tests, for lack of a better word, suck. And they may give basic level knowledge, but you can't really evaluate understanding in that format. But you can evaluate understanding through relationships. So if an individual is an active participant in a network situated within an ecology over a period of time, there'll be a group of people that'll be able to say, yes, George knows what he's talking about. And these will be people who are the experts, if you will, that have been in the community as well, really in a typical master concept in an atelier model almost, a studio model of learning. So I think we need to not look at accreditation as a new value point based on our current view of accreditation, our view of what assessing accreditation also has to be altered in the space.
Thank you.
Agreed.
Question. That feeds directly into the question that I'm going to try to ask. When I look at our muddy ecology that we're talking about here, and I like the sort of dirty, planty model that you guys are putting forth, the basic set of literacies that we're looking at transferring here, and when I look at the failure rates, we're talking about the literacies from, I hate to say bygone era, but for an older model. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, if we create this muddy ecology and we let people play on it, will those literacies not themselves grow out? We not just by, we're talking about creating the basic set that people need to do what? In most university environments, we're talking about what you need to be an academic, mm-hmm. whatever mm-hmm. kind of academic you're going to be used. If those people come into this ecology and try to do the things that they need to do as a researcher, whether they're first, second, third year, whatever they are, again, speaking to universities, those literacies, I think, will come out of their own if the ecology is built properly. So do you think it's even necessary to write those out, or is it more a question of watching the literacies evolve, and that way you end up with a more authentic view of what the literacies for this century are actually going to need to be? Because I don't know if they are now.
Yes, and I want to jump in on that one, because I think that what we've all got to remind ourselves of is that there is a difference between learning and education. And that we talk about learning, and that is the thing that we all want to do, but education is the process through which much of that is being managed and operationalized, both formally and informally, that sometimes it's really hard to separate the two. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with talking about education as a means through which one can formalize the achievement of certain types of learning or competency-based outcomes. But at the end of the day, if there needs to be a way of demonstrating that exists, I mean, the issue of accreditation to identity is absolutely key. I mean, I will tell you, I work in an environment where just about everybody around me has an MBA. I have a PhD. They, to this day, I think this will happen through the rest of my life in a corporation. When I open my mouth in a meeting, they will roll their eyes and go, Professor Wagner has something to say. And, of course, you all know that when I show up at conferences like this, that, of course, the cloak of the dark side is worn very carefully across my shoulders. I mean, I wear that scarlet A with great pride, but I assure you that when I walk into an academic conference, I'm that corporate girl. So, you know, you do have to understand that all of us are going to have to figure how we can be fluid around our own identities and our own competencies. And I think that's going to be a really interesting challenge. The more that we open this dialogue and the more that we do create and flatten these opportunities for participation, that we're going to have to get pretty good at figuring out where we fall in the continuum as well.
Okay, on that note, we have about 1 minute left, so I would like to thank very much the panelists for opening the dialogue, for you for participating, and I would encourage those of you who are able to jot some ideas down and answer some questions there. Either leave them here, send them in if you'd like to be kept apprised of our project. And if you can attend the next session, which is in Ballroom C, we will be working in small groups with a facilitator answering and giving you the opportunity to answer the questions that our panelists have just gotten started on. So thank you all very much.